Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm John Sloop, along with my friends Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty. This morning, at the suggestion of one of you, our listeners, we're going to explore a contentious constitutional issue that is often referred to as the constitutional provision of the separation of church and state. The problem is, there is no such language in the Constitution. It's just not there. What the Constitution does say about the relationship of church and state is found in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, and it reads like this. The First Amendment: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The phrase separation of church and state, in fact, comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote shortly after his inauguration to the Danbury Baptist Association in Connecticut in 1802. He wrote to reassure them that the federal government had no power to establish a state church. The Baptists back then were in the minority, and they feared that the Anglicans would become the national church. And so Jefferson writes to say that that is not the case, and he used that phrase. But ever since, the phrase has been grossly misapplied. For instance, in 1962, Justice Potter Stewart wrote that jurisprudence is not aided by the uncritical invocation of metaphors like the wall of separation, a phrase, he says, nowhere found in the Constitution. And in 1985, Chief Justice William Rehnquist called Jefferson's phrase misleading, stating, and I quote, "Unfortunately, the Establishment Clause has been expressly freighted with Jefferson's misleading metaphor for nearly 40 years. So, here to clarify what I would call a constitutional heresy is our very own constitutional lawyer, Rita Dunaway. Rita, get us started on this important topic.
Can I give her a hand?
Give her a hand.
Thanks, you two. And I love that phrase, constitutional heresy. Did you come up with that,
Doc? That is original. That's original.
That's great. I might have to borrow that sometime. Well, yeah, as you pointed out, the religious liberty, the liberty of man to worship according to his own conscience, is protected by two clauses in the First Amendment. And when they are understood properly, the two clauses actually work together to secure the common goal of religious freedom. So that first clause that you read, Doc, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion," is known in legal circles as the Establishment Clause. The second clause, where it says, "or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," is known as the Free Exercise Clause. And you know, I really think it's true that no civil liberty is more debated or misunderstood than this one freedom of religious liberty. Even as the First Amendment was drafted, debated, and adopted, you know, many of the states had official established state religions. So it's very clear, no one can deny, that the Establishment Clause, which specifically applies only to Congress shall make no law. It was not intended to remove all vestiges of religion from government or from public life. Rather, it was intended to preclude the federal government from embracing one denomination to the exclusion of others, and it was meant to preserve that issue for the states.
And this is what Danbury folks were concerned about.
That's exactly right, exactly. And, you know, it really makes sense to understand it this way if you think about the ubiquitous references to God in public documents, speeches, and proclamations.
Well, Rita, you mentioned earlier that some of the states even had state religions. In addition to that, not only then, but even up to today, All 50 state constitutions make a reference to God. So there is no question that even though some people may question whether America today is a Christian nation, certainly we were founded on Judeo-Christian values and biblical truth. You asked for some examples in Washington of that, of our heritage that's written on the walls, draped from the buildings, emblazoned in concrete. And as you know, we go to Washington every year in the fall. Yep. We take this heritage tour to remind us of America's godly heritage. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of very prominent examples. In the U.S. Capitol itself, in the rotunda, the centerpiece, the heart of the Capitol building, there are 8 beautiful, huge paintings. 2 of those paintings explicitly portray America's godly heritage. The first one is the baptism of Pocahontas, which took place at Jamestown in 1613. There she is kneeling, getting baptized into the Christian faith. A second one features the pilgrims who are on their boat or on dockside, ready to depart from Holland for America. They are engaged in Bible study and prayer just before their departure. And then there are other depictions in the Capitol, the statues. There are so many statues honoring men and women of faith in their missions, whether they're medical missionaries, but there's one in particular that I like. It's a statue of John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. He is a valley pastor who in January of 1776 preached a sermon from Ecclesiastes 3, a time for peace and a time for war. And he ended that sermon, and it shows it on his statue, taking off his clerical garb, his black robe, and revealing underneath the uniform of a Continental Army officer, and then marched several days later with 300 of his neighbors off to war to fight for our
independence.
And actually,
Dean, he threatened the men in the congregation that if they didn't join him, they'd all go to hell. I think that is actually the case.
That's what John would have done, I know. But then as we move around the Capitol Mall itself, I think the most prominent ones would be Washington Monument. Now, you won't see it, but at the very top of the monument, this is where the rising sun first hits. There are 2 words on the capstone of the Washington Monument.
Laus Deo.
Laus Deo, meaning praise be to God. And so this is the heart of the Capitol. Then you go over to the Jefferson Memorial. You go to the Lincoln Memorial, replete with references to God, and there are others. So it's right there. But if I could, here we just celebrated President's Day. This is also included in the words of our past president, starting with George Washington, again revealing how religion was such an important part of America's heritage. He says, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." And then John Adams says, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by religion and morality." Thomas Jefferson, and it's inscribed on his memorial, says, "Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure if we have lost the only firm basis, a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God?" So there you have it in the inscriptions and in the words of our president.
Yeah, so I think those are really just a handful of many, many examples we could use to prove that the Establishment Clause, as originally written and intended, was never meant to do what has happened today, which is that government and even individual government officials have been expected to become completely sterile of religion, faith, reference to God. So I wanted to talk about the 2 developments in the law that I think are the reason that today we see the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment really pitted against real religious liberty. And the first development is the Incorporation Doctrine. I know that doesn't sound very exciting, but it has really thrown a wrench into the works. In 1947, there was a Supreme Court case involving state funding for kids using public transportation to get to public and private schools. The Supreme Court held that under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Establishment Clause would now apply to state governments as well as the federal government. Remember that in the First Amendment itself, it specifically says Congress shall make no law. But now we have the Supreme Court applying the Establishment Clause, which was meant to address federalism. It was meant to protect the states against interference. Now the court is applying it to state action. And that's the case where Justice Hugo Black misconstrued Thomas Jefferson's words about the First Amendment creating a wall of separation.
Well, Rita, you mentioned the 14th Amendment. That is so troubling because it not only violated the guarantees of the First Amendment that you just mentioned, but the 9th and 10th Amendments in the Bill of Rights, which says if the federal government is not specifically granted these powers, they belong to the states and to the people respectively. So that 14th Amendment that you've mentioned has become very troubling.
You mean in its application specifically to the Establishment Clause?
Precisely.
Sure.
Well, and to many other issues that have come up subsequently.
Yeah,
but
liberty,
certainly,
yeah.
Indeed. John, you've already mentioned some of the background for what happened with the Danbury Baptists and Thomas Jefferson in his letter in 1802. As I've been doing some research on that, I was fascinated. There's another wrinkle to that that I had never heard before. First of all, we've already said they were concerned that Thomas Jefferson and others were going to push a national religion that would preclude the Baptists from practicing their faith.
Right.
Another concern that they had, which I didn't know until just recently in my reading, they were concerned that the very fact that you had to codify our free exercise of religion meant that it was a grant from government rather than a gift from God. And so they wanted an assurance from Thomas Jefferson. Are you going to protect the free exercise of our religion, or are we going to confirm and affirm that this is an inalienable right derived from our Creator? And in his letter, in his response to them, he specifically referred to natural law, which in those days referred to the law of God, and it was a reassurance to them that he was going to protect those rights.
Yeah. So this 1947 interpretation really throws a wrench into any effort to apply the Establishment Clause as it was originally intended, because effectively the court has now converted language designed to protect states from federal interference in religious matters into language that restricts and limits states themselves. So this incorporation and the Establishment Clause's application to state governments was really the beginning of the removal of religion from public life, including, perhaps most obviously, in the public schools.
Rita, you mentioned earlier two developments that have pitted the Establishment Clause against religious liberty. And I understand that the first development is this application of the Establishment Clause at the state level, where it was originally meant as a limitation against the federal government. What then would be the second development?
Doc, thanks for keeping us on track here.
my best.
Yeah. The second development, I would say, is a judicial broadening, a change in the substantive meaning of the Establishment Clause by an activist court. So, in other words, it's the question, what is an establishment of religion? Because remember, in the First Amendment, Congress is prohibited from establishing a religion. So while history suggests that the evil the first Congress sought to prevent was that of coercion of any type of religious practice or support through the government, the modern interpretation is that the Establishment Clause prohibits the government and even individual government officials from advancing, fostering, or endorsing religion, even in a general sense. And that is really broad language. Endorsing, you know, what does it mean to endorse something? The Supreme Court says that the government is to maintain, and I quote, neutrality between religion and religion and between religion and non-religion.
Rita, neutrality. That is a fascinating concept.
Indeed.
That means that you do not distinguish between good and evil. And I'd like to suggest here that not only do we have the First Amendment, but we have Jesus' words, that we need to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, we need to give to God what is God's, and God makes a very clear distinction between what is right and what is wrong. So how on earth can the court maintain neutrality? If that means that they are to erase religion from the public square, that is not neutral. That is hostile to religion.
Indeed. And I would say that is precisely what has happened. This quest for this elusive idea of neutrality between religion and non-religion has actually led the court's jurisprudence down a path toward complete secularism. In the eyes of a postmodern society, it's better to rid the public square of religion completely than to risk allowing some members of society to be offended or to feel like outsiders. Those are phrases actually used in federal court decisions now.
I love this court. Oh, that it would spare me from ever being offended by anybody or anything.
Yeah.
But that really leads to confusion, and it goes against what the founders intended when they said religion and morality are indispensable supports to government. So there is an example that you might want to talk about. You could talk about 1,000, but one in particular, and I know it has affected some of our local governments. Can we or can we not pray in a public building before a government event? And I recall specifically a year or two ago, there was this case, a Supreme Court case in New York, the town of Greece versus Galloway, where a couple of, you mentioned being offended, mm-hmm. there were a couple of people in the room when the city council prayed before their meeting. Now, is that, what does a court do if they want everything to be neutral?
Yeah. Well, Dean, the Valley Family Forum actually had some involvement in that Supreme Court case, didn't we?
Well, we did, Rita, and I just have to give thanks to you. You really took the lead on this for us. You made clear from the very beginning that the Valley Family Forum is not just to be a chit-chat society.
That's right.
So we can chit-chat about what's going on in New York, but what you helped us with, we ended up filing a friend of the court brief in this case to argue against that appellate court ruling that these invocations were a violation of our First Amendment. And, amazingly, our side actually won.
Yeah, that's right. Just to
Can I just weigh in here with a little experience I had recently, which really encouraged me right to this point. I attended a meeting of our local city council, and I was thrilled that the meeting began with prayer. And the city council members pray themselves and take turns doing it. And I want to just commend the city of Harrisonburg, our city council people, for not bowing down to this political correctness pressure. And I just thought that was very encouraging.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, just to expound a little bit more on that Supreme Court case, the policy in that New York town was to allow clergy from any area church, not just Christian churches, any area church, the clergy were allowed to come to the public meeting and offer an invocation at the beginning of the meeting. The Supreme Court issued a great decision in that case. I was so pleased with it. And the court held that a neutral policy like this one did not violate the Establishment Clause just because a couple of people were offended. And now I know what you're both thinking. You're both thinking that's a no-brainer. Why were you so excited, Rita? But the truth is, we have had some really bad federal court precedents, even here in the Fourth Circuit, which Virginia falls under. There had been some really bad decisions dealing with neutral policies just like this one.
So, Rita, what would you say have been the practical results of these developments in Establishment Clause jurisprudence?
Yeah, well, first, from a legal perspective, what we see happening, unfortunately, is that the lines that are drawn in these cases where cities and towns actually have to litigate these questions, the lines appear arbitrary and sometimes even downright silly. For instance, displays of the Ten Commandments on public property. It is impossible to predict how the Supreme Court would actually rule on those situations. In Van Orden versus Perry, the court upheld a Texas display of the Ten Commandments on state capitol grounds. But on the very same day, the Supreme Court struck down displays of the Ten Commandments in Kentucky courthouses. So it's just really hard to predict what's going to happen.
What do you know the history there? What were some of the reasons for the difference of opinion?
Well, it usually just has to do with the history leading up to the displays and the context. And on that note of context, let me tell you this silly scenario. In Lynch versus Donnelly, the Supreme Court upheld a city's Christmas display because it included a Santa Claus house, reindeer pulling Santa's sleigh, candy-striped poles, a Christmas tree, carolers, and a religious nativity scene. But only 5 years later, the court held unconstitutional a city's display of just the nativity scene inside a city building. So the rule that we have to glean from this as attorneys is that whether or not a holiday display on public grounds is constitutional depends on whether there are candy-striped poles and reindeer around. Mm. Does that seem silly to you?
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then finally, as far as the practical results of this, the Supreme Court construes the Establishment Clause to forbid hostility to religion. That's a fact. It says that over and over again in its decisions. But what really happens is that in order to avoid lawsuits, because they don't know how they're going to turn out, public officials tend to adopt a stance of, when in doubt, religion is out, because it's just easier.
Rita and Dean, we've learned so much today. We've learned that a phrase that was written in a letter having nothing to do with a court case has been misapplied and has sort of worked its way in. I think a survey shows that the vast majority of Americans believe the phrase separation of church and state is, in fact, in the Constitution. So there needs to be a lot of work to re-educate, to remove that from the American consciousness.
Well, let me point out something related to that I think is really problematic, and I'm sure you are both aware of this. There's a tendency for a lot of people who, you know, maybe just read headlines having to do with, quote unquote, the separation of church and state, right? Which is not actually in the Constitution. And they think that because of that principle and just what they've heard in the media and what they've seen in the newspapers, they think that what the First Amendment means is that if you're a person wanting to go have some involvement in the public square, maybe in the legislature, or maybe you are a legislator, they think that if your policy position on legislation or any kind of public policy issue is motivated by your faith, your biblical worldview, or your religious beliefs, that somehow disqualifies you from participation.
Yep. I think one of the things that's very helpful to me in understanding this separation of church and state, I should clarify before I say this, I have said on a number of occasions that this idea of the separation of church and state is a lie from the pit of hell. Well, I need to apologize to people to whom I have said this, because in fact, as I mentioned earlier, Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. He made very clear that there's a separation. That's the way it is intended. That's the way it should be understood. But that line that separates church and state, according to the Constitution now, is a permeable wall, which is to say, the church is the conscience of the nation. The church's voice must penetrate that wall as a voice of conscience between good and evil for the nation, as a guiding light for the nation to follow. It is impermeable from the other direction. The government has no right to penetrate that law and tell the church what it can and cannot do. I find that very helpful. Rita, is that the way it should be understood?
Well, it just makes me, going back to my earlier point, I'm just still thinking about that because it's so upsetting to me. You know, the idea that a person going into the public policy arena can somehow check their beliefs at the door and come in to propose legislation or public policy without any kind of basis in their worldview or their belief system, it's just absurd. And, you know, we hear all this talk of, well, you can't legislate morality. Well, come on. The truth is all legislation is based on some sort of morality,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah. I think, you know, we do have some clues as to original intent. I remember being amazed at learning about the Northwest Ordinance, which was a bill passed by Congress in the, was it 1789, 1790?
Yes, 1789, when the Constitution was ratified.
At the same time in which they were passing this First Amendment, and they passed this Northwest Ordinance that said that religion and morality should be taught in the schools as the country moved to the Northwest. And so here's Congress saying religion is absolutely indispensable to the fabric of our nation. And then they passed this First Amendment, meaning there's no inconsistency here.
Right.
One of the great privileges of my life was to be invited by Bob Goodlatte to pray before the U.S. Congress. And so Congress has their own chaplain. They have prayer at the beginning of every meeting, which shows that historically this whole thing has been misapplied.
Right, because under the Supreme Court's current tests, if they were really to faithfully apply the kind of jurisprudential test they apply to other cases right now, that having a prayer in Congress would be totally invalid.
Exactly.
So they cannot allow that historical tradition to continue without coming up with all these, you know, creative ideas about how to let that be okay when really under the current test it's not. I want to say one more thing to explain the importance of understanding in the context of religious speech in public places, that the Establishment Clause, even the way it's applied today, applies only to official action. It does nothing to limit an individual's personal private speech. I just want to make that clear.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Dean, for an informative program. We could go on for another hour, I'm sure.
Can we follow this up next week?
Well, I think we will. We're going to follow up next week with the church as the conscience of the nation. Actually, I wish we could take our Crossroads team and what we've talked about today and teach it in our public schools because it's so necessary. Now, we'd love to hear your comments, your compliments, and your complaints. So write us at crossroadsharrisonburg@gmail.com. And a reminder, all Crossroads programs are archived on the Valley Family Forum website. That's www.valleyfamilyforum.org. This is John Sloop, along with Rita and Dean, encouraging you to be salt and light
and to make a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.